This Civic Media podcast is sponsored by UW Organ and Tissue Donation. Organ donations are desperately needed, and now is the right time to become an organ donor. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. Go to heroicdeed.com.
Welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show. I am not Maggie Dawn. I am Dan Schaefer. I'm your guest host this afternoon for the Maggie Dawn Show. Thank you so much for joining us. If you are unfamiliar with me or my work, I am the founder of the Recombobulation Area, a weekly opinion column and online publication covering news and politics in Milwaukee and Wisconsin. And the Recombobulation Area is now part of Civic Media. And I am also now the political editor at Civic Media as well. So you may have heard me on a number of other shows. I'm on every Friday on Matt Nair on Air. I've joined Todd Alba's show in recent weeks. I think I've made the rounds on just about every Civic Media show since I've been in this role. But I haven't really done a whole lot of guest hosting. So apologies in advance if I do get discombobulated over the course of the show. My goal is to bring us all back together, recombobulate as best we can. We have discombobulating politics in the state of Wisconsin, and we want to, you know, recombobulate and put those together. That's what we're hoping to bring here on Civic Media and at the Recombobulation Area. If you've been joining us for the remainder of the show here, we were joined before the break by Natasha Kerecki of NBC News. She was talking to us about the race for DNC chair. I also have a piece up at the Recombobulation Area today about that DNC chair race, because it, of course, has a Wisconsin connection, as all things do. State Party Chair Ben Wickler is potentially in the mix for that role. He is seriously considering running for it. I had one source tell me he would be the Goldilocks candidate for that role. So do check out that piece when you get the opportunity. But we are thrilled here to be joined by our next guest on the show this afternoon. We're going to be switching gears a little bit and from politics, talking a little sports, talking a little Milwaukee Bucks, with the beat reporter of the Milwaukee Bucks at The Athletic. Eric Name joins us for this next segment here. Eric, welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show.
Thank you for having me.
So I must say, I have not, as big of a Bucks fan as I am, because of, you know, some certain things that have been in the news over the past couple months, I have not been watching all that much of the Bucks, not following it quite as closely as I do when there's, say, oh, I don't know, just not an election happening in the state of Wisconsin. But I made it out to my first Bucks game of the year on Monday and saw a really fun one where the Bucks defeated the Houston Rockets in a game that was really back and forth, really close, and a terrific performance from Brook Lopez in that one. You know, he's one of the oldest members of the team, and he's still putting together incredible performances like he did the other night.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty crazy to think that, you know, he just keeps doing it. You know, he came to Milwaukee in 2018, signed him on a biannual exception, something the Bucks haven't been able to access in many, many years, because all they have is minimums at their disposal because they're so deep into the luxury tax. But yeah, came in 2018. At that point, I think there was a lot of people that thought, maybe his career's over. Maybe this is the last stop. He'll have a season or two, and that will be that. He was trying to find himself. And under Mike Budenholzer, he found a brand new identity. He just blocks a ton of shots, shoots a ton of threes, and is just a huge emotional leader for this Bucks team, and has been since he got here. And the same has kind of been true for this season. You know, this season did not start off the way that it has, but I mean, you look at two of Brook's biggest performances that came in the last three games. And, you know, that Pistons game, he had five threes. I think it's four blocks. It's three steals. You know, a huge offensive night to go with a huge defensive night. And it really felt like it was like him and Giannis willing the Milwaukee Bucks to a win. And again, if you watch that Rockets game, it was like, well, Damian Lillard is coming back from a concussion and he's not quite right. And Giannis is struggling with turnovers tonight. How are they going to find their way through? And Brooke Lopez is like, how about I shoot 30 footers? And yeah, that works.
Yeah,
and
he was really launching them from deep. It wasn't just that, you know, it wasn't just like the toe on the line threes. He was really launching them the other night.
Yeah,
he was feeling himself a little bit too. Like he got, you know, he was hyping himself up after a couple of the big blocks that he had, a couple of those big threes. The crowd was loving it. It was a terrific game from Brooke Lopez. If you'd have told me when they signed him in the summer of 2018 that in 2024 he'd still be putting up games like that, I would have been very surprised.
Yeah, no, he's an ageless wonder. He just continues to do it. And the Bucks need everything they can get right now because it has not been the best start to this season.
No, it hasn't. So maybe you know, me tuning in a little bit more regularly can turn the tide for the Bucks.
Yeah. They've got a game against
the Chicago Bulls tonight. They've got a lot of games on the schedule coming up against Eastern Conference teams. And you know, the Bucks record as it stands is at 5-9, not where you'd want to be at this point of the season. But I think there's, you know, just looking ahead at the next month or so here, there's an opportunity to gain some ground because, for one, they still have Giannis Antetokounmpo, who is still, you know, I'll homer it up here. He's the best player in the world. And I think, you know, you have an Eastern Conference. When you look at the landscape across the Eastern Conference, it is a very weak conference across the board this year outside of those top two teams in the Boston Celtics and Cleveland Cavaliers.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't checked the standings today, but I know when they won the other night against the Rockets, they were half game out of the play-in at 5-9. It is not their strongest conference. It is, you know, really top-heavy. You have the Cavs and the Celtics who faced off last night. Those two teams are probably going to win 60-plus games. Like, they're just that good. They are really, like, running machine-like kind of operations in both cities. And that's kind of great for the Bucks, especially the way that they started this season. Like, it's okay, those two can run away, beat up on everyone in the Eastern Conference, other than the Bucks, obviously. But that should hopefully put them in a spot where, I mean, it's not out of the realm of possibilities that they could still be the 3 seed in the Eastern Conference. Like, there's really no other teams that are, you know, kind of taking that mantle. The other teams that were hyped up in the same way that the Milwaukee Bucks were in that second tier, the Cavs have jumped up, but the Sixers are even lower than the Bucks. They're 2-11 mm-hmm. right now. You look at the New York Knicks, they've had ups and downs. They've been trying to figure out exactly what's going on and how they're going to do things. So the Bucks kind of get themselves in a spot where, you know, they can still make some noise in the Eastern Conference. And if you get to a spot where, you know, you are facing the Cleveland Cavaliers in the second round, I think that's a matchup you're probably not all that fearful of. Like, I understand by that point, they'll probably have won 60 some games and they'll look great, but the Bucks went toe to toe with them twice. One time they didn't have two of their big three. The other time they didn't have one of their big three in Chris Middleton. And like, I just think this is a season that is not over yet. They started off 2-8. They lose to the Boston Celtics. Four of their first 10 games were against the Celtics and the Cavaliers. So they got a number of those tough games out of the way early. Unfortunately, they were losses. So they start 2-8, but they go to Boston on December 6th. You mentioned the stretch that they're in right now. It's 11 games between that Celtics game that dropped in the 2-8 and the next one on December 6th. In that 11 games, they were playing 9 teams in the Eastern Conference that were under 500. They faced the best team was the Houston Rockets, who were 10-4 coming into the game the other night. They just beat them. It's very realistic looking at that schedule, and especially with the way the Bucks have played recently, that they could win 8 of those 11 games, and then all of a sudden you're at a spot where when you're facing the Celtics, you're not that far off from 500. And I mean, even if you look at this week, they snuck out a game against the Rockets. Obviously, they wanted that one against the Hornets on Saturday. They didn't get it. Obviously, a controversy in that one as well. But if you all of a sudden get to the end of this homestand, which ends on Saturday, and the Bucks have beat the Bulls, who are very beatable. They beat the Pacers, who are very beatable, and they beat the Hornets, who, as they've already shown, are very beatable. All of a sudden, you are, I'm pretty sure that would be 8-9 at that point. And then you go to Miami, who's been a mess, and maybe you win that one. And then all of a sudden, you're 500. And 500 is not where this team wants to be. This is a team that has championship aspirations. They've all been very clear about that and how they feel about that. But after such a horrid start, like that, after that 2-8 start, they could realistically, in the 10 games following it, dig themselves all the way out of it and just have a 500 start to the season in the first quarter of the year. And that's not great. That's not what they want. But man, it looks a whole lot better than it did after 10 games.
If you're just joining us, we are joined here by Eric Naim, beat reporter for the Milwaukee Bucks at The Athletic. I am your guest host this afternoon. My name is Dan Schaefer. I am a huge Milwaukee Bucks fan, so that's why I've got Eric on here talking about the Bucks. Nobody knows the Bucks as well as Eric Naim, covering the team for The Athletic for many years now. You know, like you mentioned, there's an opportunity for the Bucks over the next bit here to kind of right the ship as far as the record goes. What are some of the things that you're looking for them to be able to kind of put that together, to put a little bit of a run together? I think, you know, I've seen some strong play from some of the bench players. Doc Rivers has kind of retooled that lineup a little bit. What are you looking for in these next couple games here?
Yeah, I think if you look at, you know, you can kind of break the season up into different segments, but over the last 2 weeks, this is a team that has been fifth in defensive rating. They are still on the season 18th because they were so bad on defense to start the season, but they have found their way on that side of the floor. They've been switching more. They've been getting more deflections. They've been causing more turnovers. They've just been a lot better on the defensive end. And as far as like where there's room for growth, where there's room for opportunity, like, the offense is still 21st in the league. And if you're looking at kind of what they're all about, Giannis is putting up numbers that are better than he's ever put up before. Damian Lillard has been spectacular when he's played. It's literally just the rest of the roster has gone through a huge shooting slump. It has not been good, honestly. Like, Brooke Lopez is 5 of 8 the other night and 5 of 8 the game before that, but he was starting the season 27% from three. Gary Trent Jr., great shooter, career 38% three-point shooter, 23% from three. Bobby Portis, like, just down the line, you know, they haven't shot the ball as well as they could, and I think that's a real opportunity for growth for them.
All right, we will keep talking about this with Eric Naim after the break here. You are listening to The Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Network. I'm your guest host this afternoon, Dan Schaefer. Stick with us. More Bucks talk after the break.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back to the Maggie Dawn Show. I'm your guest host this afternoon. My name is Dan Schaefer. We're joined here to take a little break from some politics as part of the show here and talk a little Milwaukee Bucks. Anyone who knows me or follows me on the platform formerly known as Twitter knows I'm a pretty big Milwaukee Bucks fan. And now that, you know, we're past the election, it's Bucks season for me. It's, you know, it's election season's over. Now it's Bucks season. So here to talk about that is Eric Naim. Of The Athletic. We've been talking a little bit about Brooke Lopez having a great game the other night. We've been talking about the opportunity that the Bucks have to maybe rip off a few wins in the coming weeks here. But what we haven't talked about yet is the Bucks' third star, Chris Middleton, who's yet to play a game for the Milwaukee Bucks this year. Eric, what's going on with Chris? I want to see Chris play some basketball.
Yeah, I think everyone in the organization does. I think everyone in the city does. That would be great. But, you know, with Chris, it really is a situation where, it feels like he's kind of stalled out. The Bucks will not say that he's had a setback, taken any step backs or anything like that. And that's good to hear. Like, obviously, a setback or a step back would be worse. But he's gotten to a spot where there just doesn't seem to be any more linear progress happening. He got to a spot where it was 3-on-3, doing some 4-on-4, and 5-on-5 comes next. And then once you play 5-on-5, then you can play NBA basketball. That's how it all works. 5-on-5 has now not happened for 2 weeks after, the thought was that he would be getting close to that step. And that is obviously concerning. And obviously, I think this has not gone the way that anyone thought or expected it. Like, the thing I keep kind of thinking back to is, like, I stood in Irvine, California at training camp with Chris Middleton and, asked him about, hey, how do you judge success in this season? And I gave him the baseline of the last healthy regular season he had. That was, I think 21-22, 66 games played, 31 minutes a game. He went to an All-Star game that year. But I even said, I'm not even saying, you need to be an All-Star. I'm just saying, does 65 games in 30 minutes a game sound like a successful season to you? Fully knowing, hey, Chris hasn't played a lot of back-to-backs in the last few years. I'm already crossing some of those off. The Bucks have 16 back-to-backs this year. So in my head, 65 felt like the round fair number. And Chris was pretty blunt and was like, no, that's not good enough. I would not consider it a successful season for me if I did not play 70 to 75 games. There is always going to be an insane amount of confidence in any professional athlete. You are always going to have that self-belief. But I do think it is noteworthy to think back to the first week of October and Chris Middleton thinking there's a world where he can play 70 to 75 games and not think that this has gone the way that he was expecting it. Because I just don't think, as a logical person, you would say, this is what I expect from a successful season, setting yourself up to not meet those goals. And we've seen this happen in the past with Chris where, the progress he's making to get back on the floor goes well. And then there's just that little period where he's not going the way that you hoped. And his progress is not going in the way that you need it to, and he kind of stalls out, and that really feels like where we are right now, where the Bucks aren't going to, they've never put out a timeline for Chris Middleton, they'll never put out a timeline for Chris Middleton or really any injured players. It's not something that they do as an organization.
They are committed to being very quiet about injuries.
This is what they do. They did it with Brooke Lopez years ago with his back before he got back surgery. This is the thing that they believe in keeping these things as quiet and as secret as possible. It is now to the point where, Doc Rivers is going to sit in pregame I'm going to talk to him in about an hour. And when I talk to him in an hour, I'm going to ask him about Chris Middleton, and he is going to have to tell me whatever has happened with Chris Middleton. And it's likely not going to be good news, because there has not been good news for Chris Middleton and his return in many, many weeks.
Yeah. And I know in a lot of those interviews, Doc Rivers will remind you that he is not an actual doctor, which is a line the dad joke he is trotting out over and over again in this process. But before we wrap up here, let's end on a positive note. And when it comes to the Milwaukee Bucks, the positive note is always going to be with Giannis Antetokounmpo, who is once again putting together a terrific start to the season.
He's insane. He's absolutely insane. He's just an unbelievable basketball player that obviously we haven't seen in Milwaukee since Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was around. Frankly, people around the league haven't seen a guy like this. We are talking about one of the 20 greatest players in NBA history. That's how good he is. And despite putting up numbers he's never put up before last year, when he had 30 points, 11 rebounds, and he shot 60% from the he's somehow even better this year. he's averaging 31 points per game, 12 rebounds per game, six assists per game. He's shooting 60% from the field again. We've seen him. I think if you're really hoping or looking for optimism about, you know, how Giannis is going to age, this is the best mid-range shooting season he's had to start, you know, any season, really. Like before the Charlotte game, he was shooting 50% from the mid-range. He's still shooting about 45%. And those are the shots that, yeah, it might frustrate people that, you know, he's not getting to the rim. But, you know, like the question I asked him after the Charlotte game when he took a step-back jumper to try to win the game, I said, you know, how do you try to make the decision between trying to get downhill and get to the rim where you dominate and taking a jumper? And he was just like, I couldn't. I know I try to play to my strength, which is being around the rim, but I couldn't. And if you can't do that all the time, if teams are going to build a wall, you got to have something else. And if you can shoot it at 45% from the mid range, that's going to be really helpful. Save his legs, make it a little bit easier and allow him to dominate in the ways that he has previously, but then also in new and fresh ways.
He's just such a terrific player. He's shooting that mid-range shot with a little bit more confidence this year, it feels like, and that's really great to see. Eric, we will continue to follow all of your terrific reporting at The Athletic. Subscribe, follow, all of the things. Eric's work is the best, is as good as it gets for Bucks coverage in Wisconsin. So follow him there and stick with us here on The Maggie Dawn Show. We'll be joined by John D. Johnson of Marquette University talking about some state legislative election results after the break here. Stick with us.
You're an organ donor, right? Well, here's a tragic fact. Approximately 20 people die each day waiting for precious donated organs. You could make a life-saving decision simply by getting that important dot on your driver's license. That little dot shows those who need to know that you've made a decision to donate organs at a critical time. Go to heroicdeed.com to learn more about the importance of organ donation and how you can make your wishes known. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. HeroicDeed.com.
Welcome back to The Maggie Dawn Show. I am not Maggie Dawn. I am Dan Schaefer. I'm your guest host this afternoon. Thank you so much for joining us. Just wanted to take a minute to remind you that you can download the new Civic Media app. There's a new version of the app for you to download and enjoy. You can sign up for news updates in your local community. You can select your favorite shows like The Maggie Dawn Show to listen to live, to listen to podcasts, all sorts of great things with the new Civic Media app. So be sure to download that one. If you are just joining us, once again, I'm your guest host this afternoon. Maggie Dawn will be back on Monday of next week in the usual time slot. I am guest hosting today. There will be a couple other guest hosts for the rest of the week here. So be sure to tune in for all of the great coverage that we have across the Civic Media Network. For our next segment here, we are joined by John D. Marquette University. John has done a whole lot of work analyzing, breaking down data and so forth from the election results. And I asked him to join this week because he just wrote a piece a couple days ago called "Donald Trump Won 50 Wisconsin Assembly Seats, So Did Tammy Baldwin." John, first, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So this piece, you know, really takes a look at what happened in the election and how it mapped onto the Wisconsin State Assembly in the 99 districts in the Wisconsin State Assembly. So this first election since the previous maps were struck down by the Wisconsin Supreme Court. We, of course, had this kind of fraught, crazy process to find new maps. They were eventually the ones that were proposed by Governor Tony Evers, passed in the Wisconsin State Legislature, and then signed into law by the governor in February, setting up this kind of unique election where we now saw the results, where we have an 18-15 Republican majority in the state Senate and a 54-45 Republican majority in the state assembly. But as you charted here, you know, it was a pretty even split if you look at what happened at the top of the ticket. What were some of your key takeaways here?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, truly a very even split in the state assembly. It's just that Republican state assembly candidates are more popular than top of the ticket Republicans are. So yeah, Donald Trump won the state by about a point, won 50 seats in the assembly. That's a one seat majority. Tammy Baldwin also won the state by about a point and also won 50 states. So, you know, those of you who can do math will notice that that means there's at least one district that went both ways. And that is the 85th, the Wausau seat, voted for Tammy Baldwin and Donald Trump. And of course, the Republican in the state assembly, the Republican candidate, won that seat as well and won it by more than Donald Trump did. In fact, there's only one Republican candidate who got less of the two-party vote than Donald Trump. Only one winning Republican assembly candidate who did that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think, you know, incumbency is always a really big factor in these down ballot elections. I think you've kind of, correct me if I'm wrong, but you've put a numerical quality to this as well. Is it like a 4-point advantage that you know, incumbents tend to have in these types of down ballot races in the legislature?
You can kind of decompose incumbency advantage into two parts. One part is name recognition, and the other part is being better at running campaigns because you have more practice and more money. Mm-hmm. And whenever we have redistricting, we get this fun opportunity to actually measure those two pieces separately, because when the districts are redrawn, incumbents run in the new district where some of the voters are their old voters with whom they should enjoy name recognition, and some of the voters are new voters. They won't really have name recognition with those voters, but they will still have the benefit of running a stronger campaign. And so when I looked at this in 2022, we found that in those wards that were also part of the candidate's previous district, incumbency advantage was worth 4 points. So in a seat that was toss-up otherwise, you would expect the incumbent to get 52% to 48% for the challenger. And then the advantage was about half that size in the wards which were new to the district. So you would expect them to get like 51% of the vote in those districts. And the size of the incumbency advantage was the same for Democrats and Republicans in 2022. It's just that there were more Republican incumbents, so the aggregate effect benefited that party. We see the same thing this year. And when the final data gets released, I'll go ahead and replicate that analysis to see what incumbency advantage was worth this year. Clearly, it was worth something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, we've seen that at the top of the ticket in Wisconsin, too. You know, the midterm elections 2 years ago where Tony Evers was reelected and Ron Johnson was reelected. You know, incumbency can really matter here quite a bit. And of the there were, as you noted in your piece here, there were five Republican assembly candidates that won districts that Trump lost. Most of them were incumbents. Bob Donovan in the southwestern Milwaukee suburbs, he ran a little bit ahead of Trump in his district. Todd Novak in the Dodgeville area in southwestern Wisconsin, he also ran a few points ahead of Trump. And then also Jesse Rodriguez, another seat in the Milwaukee County suburbs. She ran a few points ahead of Trump as well. So we see how, you know, it's going to, even though we have new maps and we have this new opportunity for that Democrats could have, you know, competed for the majority in a way they really didn't have the opportunity to for more than a decade. It's still going to take some time for Democrats to kind of build that level of support in some of these key races that will be, you know, in like when we broke this down at Civic Media and at the recombobulation area, you know, many of these toss-up races maybe had the math slightly favoring Democrats, but because you had incumbents on the ballot, you had, you know, and also, you know, in some other districts, some stronger candidates that Republicans were running, people who had, you know, a record of kind of bipartisan type of activity in the past, you know, it's going to take some time for Democrats to build up that level of support. But now that they will have, you know, a greater number of representatives, you know, in 2026, it gives them a little bit of a, you know, greater advantage going into that, but by instead of trying to flip some districts, you know, it's a little bit easier to try to protect those districts going forward.
Yeah, I'd add two things to that. On the one hand, we hear so much about this being a bad era for incumbent parties just around the world, from, you know, India to France to the UK. We've seen incumbents struggle. And that's true. And I think it has some explanatory power for how we think about how the presidential race worked. But when you get down to these local races, it's still good to be an incumbent. It's pretty clear. I also want to say that all these seats, the ones you just named, they were really close still. This was a good year for Republicans on election night. Most of the state shifted a little bit towards the Republicans from 2020 to 2024. But you can imagine in a year where the wind is going in the other direction politically, most of these seats would probably fall the other way. They were that close.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, we're joined by John D. Johnson of Marquette University. He's been breaking down some of the data for the Wisconsin State Legislature, which you can really see in this piece that you wrote, the impact of new maps, because you compared what these election results would look like under the maps that were signed into law for this election, and how they might have looked in previous maps, including the maps in 2022 and some of the other ones that were proposed as part of the process for Wisconsin adopting some of the new maps. What really stood out to you there?
It's wild how much of a difference the maps you have make. So as we said, Trump won the majority of the vote in 50 of the current seats. If we had run this election under the maps we used in 2022, Trump would have won a majority in 64 of those districts. Same votes, cast in the same places, but a 14-seat difference. Truly wild. There was one plan put forward, the one by the progressive law firm Law Forward. I think they're based in Madison. And that one, actually, Trump would have only won 48 seats despite winning the state by a point. So you can see how the Evers map, the one we have now, at least in the assembly, didn't push the dial quite as far as Democrats maybe could have. It's actually a little bit of a different story in the state Senate. But another remarkable thing is, you may recall the People's Map Commission that Evers put together way back in round one of the 2020 redistricting cycle. And
I sure do. That was, it was, who can forget the People's Maps Commission? I guess nerds like myself who were looking at redistricting and following that process very closely. But just to refresh our listeners, this was a kind of ostensibly nonpartisan commission that the governor had put together to try and find new maps in the normal cycle, kind of following the census after 2020.
Yeah. And so Evers put forward this like list of criteria that this commission would use, and they were all sort of rigorous, nonpartisan, good government ideas about keeping communities together, being compact, that kind of thing. And Republicans really saw this as a Democratic ploy to get something sort of past them. But actually, when you look at how this election would have gone down under those maps that the People's Map Commission proposed, like we said, Trump won 50 seats under the current maps, 64 under the old maps we used in 2022. If we'd used those People Map Commission maps, he would have won 55 in the assembly. So 5 seats better for Republicans than what they ended up with, which speaks to the level of sort of baked in Republican advantage that exists in Wisconsin's current political geography, worth about 5 seats probably. Which is a lot less than the old Republican gerrymander did, but also more than what Democrats ended up getting out of this map that Evers drew.
Yeah, I just want to reiterate that point that you're making there. So, and I would encourage our listeners to go find John's piece on this at bluebookmke.substack.com. And it's crazy to think that the same votes from the same people in the same election cycle, just based on how the maps are drawn, on one map would produce 64 Republican state representatives, and the other map produce 50 Republican state representatives. That's how much of a difference you can really see from that, that how much gerrymandering factors into this, how much redistricting matters. And I think that's why, you know, so many people who are, you know, really following this stuff at a granular level focused so much on what was happening with redistricting, because it just is such a major factor on the makeup of the Wisconsin state legislature. And that is the, you know, the decisions that are made in the Wisconsin state legislature can often have a much more direct impact on your day-to-day life as a Wisconsinite. And because, you know, and your ability to impact change, you know, on the local level, on the state level, that so much of those decisions go back to what's happening in the Wisconsin state legislature. So I think, you know, as we kind of look ahead to the, some of the political battles that are ahead for this new narrower Republican majority, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see how those tighter maps factor into, you know, the actual process of legislating as well. And how, you know, people might respond to the greater accountability that voters can deliver by having more competitive seats, by having more toss-up districts. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see as we get into next year, if there's going to be a situation in, you know, like in the state Senate, where, you know, you might have some Republican senators, let's say in districts won by Kamala Harris, having to moderate some of their positions and not adopt always the further right types of positions. We're joined here by John D. Johnson of Marquette University, who's been breaking down some of the data with the results of the Wisconsin State Legislature. John's going to stick with us for one more segment here on The Maggie Don Show. I am your guest host this afternoon, Dan Schaefer, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back to the Maggie Don Show. I'm your guest host this afternoon. My name is Dan Schaefer. Thank you so much for joining us. Once again, I'll remind you that I have a new piece up at the Recombobulation Area today talking about Ben Wickler potentially running for chair of the Democratic National Committee. So do check that one out. I want to also thank our guests who have joined us throughout the show here, Natasha Karecki of NBC News. She's been reporting on the DNC chair race there. And we're also joined by Eric Name of The Athletic. And for the last segment here, we are joined by John D. Johnson of Marquette University. We've been talking a little bit about the results in the state legislature. You know, there was obviously so much attention paid to the top of the ticket, to Donald Trump's victory, to Tammy Baldwin's victory. And John has really been breaking down a lot of the results at the legislative level. You know, one of the things that's been in the news today, we talked about at the open of the show, was that the Wisconsin Democratic Party of Wisconsin endorsed a candidate in the Wisconsin Supreme Court race today, Susan Crawford, who is emerging as, you know, really the only liberal candidate running in this race. And one of the key decisions that the liberal majority on the Wisconsin Supreme Court made was about the maps. They struck down Wisconsin's maps, legislative maps, as unconstitutional. And so, you know, I think a lot of people might be wondering, you know, what is the possibility of the maps changing again, depending on the outcome of this race for Wisconsin Supreme Court? John, what do you think?
Well, certainly possible. We've seen a lot of partisanly motivated reasoning from this court. But it's a little bit more complicated because of the specific way that we ended up with these maps. You know, it's pretty easy for the court to reverse a previous court's decision just to be like, that legal reasoning was wrong. Here's the correct legal reasoning about this issue. So you could imagine the old maps were thrown out on the basis of the interpretation of the contiguity requirement in the state constitution. And you could imagine a new court coming in and saying, actually, that interpretation of contiguity is wrong. That case shouldn't stand. The old maps shouldn't have been thrown out. But the maps we have now were not instituted by the court. They were passed by the state legislature and signed by the governor following the appropriate political process prescribed in the state constitution. And the maps that they replaced, the ones under which the 2022 election were conducted, had themselves just been imposed by the court, which doesn't really have explicit legal grounds in the state constitution at all. So the current maps that we have now are on the firmest legal standing possible, which is not to say that they couldn't be thrown out through some sort of creative legal process, but it will be more challenging because it's not enough for a new court to simply reject the reasoning that led to the old maps being thrown out.
So certainly something that voters should be paying attention to for electing a justice to a 10-year term, right? But it maybe not as urgent of a question as it was a couple of years ago.
Yes, and I mean, I still wouldn't put, I mean, the levels of creative legal reasoning to achieve partisan ends seems boundless.
There is always some legal Calvin ball being played by some of the folks, especially the folks on the right wing side. But before we let you go, we talked a lot about the state assembly before the break here. The state Senate has, you know, that because that senators have 2-year term or 4-year terms, excuse me, only half of the Senate was up for 2024. The other half will be up for re-election in 2026. What do you see as you look ahead to that race a couple of years down the line here?
So in the first segment, we said that Donald Trump won 50, you know, he converted his 1-point statewide victory into a 1-seat majority in the state assembly. Remarkably, he only won 16 of the state Senate districts. So Harris, despite losing Wisconsin statewide, actually won a majority of the vote in a majority of the state Senate districts, which is a great outcome if you're a Democrat. The Democrats flipped all 4 of the seats that they needed to in this state Senate election. And so of the in the swing districts that they'll be competing in 2026, they have to feel good because Harris won the vote in all of them this year. So did Tammy Baldwin. And they don't even need to win all of them in order to win the state Senate. 3 out of 4 will be good enough for them. So you have to be feeling good about the state Senate if you're a Democrat. You know, still a lot of work to do for those candidates. But based on the results of this election, I think they're more optimistic than they were previously.
Yeah, that was, you know, obviously a pretty rough night for Democrats across the board on election night. But this was a real bright spot for building for the future for Democrats. Like you said, there were 5 competitive races and Democrats were able to win all 5. You know, I thought that would be and that was really the best case scenario for the state Senate Democrats there. So, you know, they job well done by the state Senate Dems, putting themselves in position to compete for the majority in 2026. John D. Johnson, I would encourage all of our listeners to follow your work on a Blue Book, on Substack, and at Marquette University, and all over the place here. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
And thanks so much to our listeners for joining us today on The Maggie Don Show and sticking with me as I recombobulated over the last couple hours. My name is Dan Schaefer. I've been your guest host this afternoon. And once again, I will encourage you to go check out the piece that I just wrote today at the Recombobulation Area on Ben Wickler and potentially running for DNC chair. Thank you so much for joining us. Dom Salvia Show is up next. Thank you so much. Be well. Oh,
the national news cycle never stops. But it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.